This Do Lectures episode features founder of leading tech company Connect in Africa, BRCK, Eric Hirstman, recorded live at the global event in Cardigan, West Wales in 2019.
So, hey, it's so good to be here. I've had the past couple days hanging out with everybody, and it's a very different type of event, so I'm glad to meet you all. So, when I first get up on stage, I know most of you are thinking, yes, he's definitely from Kenya, right? There's always a little bit of cognitive dissonance, so I thought it might be good to give you a little history. So, I grew up in South Sudan until I was about 6 years old. Why did I go there, right? My parents were linguists, so translators. They're working with this Tiposa tribe to create a written language for them. They only had an oral one. And generally, that type of work takes about 15 to 20 years, depending on the language, because you have to learn the language, you have to create an alphabet for the language, then you have to start translating it and teaching other people how to read and write their own language. So it takes a while. But in the middle of that, there was also a war. So when the war got bad, I was about 6 years old, we moved to Kenya, and I grew up mostly there, but I did bounce back and forth between Kenya and Sudan over that time. You know, my childhood was a little bit different. I went to the Arabic school in town when we moved into the town itself, which was a little bit rare. You know, we grew up with, you know, Dick Dicks and Dykers as pets. And, you know, we just grew up out in the bush. And then life changed because we moved to the city. And when we moved to the city, something else happened, which is that my dad had electricity. And it turns out that if you have a computer, even back in those days of the 80s, early 80s, you know, you can take 5 years off your translation time. So it mattered. So, you know, when I was a kid in Kenya, I did what a lot of kids in the US or Europe would do. If their dad had a computer, when he wasn't on it, I'd go and game on it at night, right? And then you try to kind of hack the back, you know, the system in the back to do some level ups and different things, right? So you're playing on a computer. And I didn't actually think of that as anything special, right? It's just your life growing up. I grew up in these places. But you know, I think one of the lessons I learned from my parents was, you know, it's possible to do hard things in difficult places, and because of that, it's progressed into my life in a little different way, which is I look for big problems to solve, right? I'm always looking for something like that because I see in Africa this great well of opportunity as well as challenges, and those challenges are so great to work on that if you can actually unlock something around it, you have a foundational change in a continent. So I'm a builder, like build things. So a couple of the companies I've started over the last 10 years, briefly on a couple of them, the red logo on the upper left is Ushahidi. It was the open source technology stack that was built for crisis and disaster response in Kenya's post-election violence. And then we made that open source so that anybody could use it anywhere else in the world. The iHub is a space in Nairobi that was made to bring the tech community together, and it grew significantly. Brick is what I do today. I'll talk a little bit about that later, but that's around connectivity itself. And then finally is AfroLabs, which is this network we made of all the tech hubs in Africa. So what started off as five of us is now over 200 across the continent. So this model of bringing the technologists, the designers, sometimes the VCs or the media, whoever it is, together to make a bigger target has really, really worked. But it's kind of easy to stand up here and talk about building things because I think my conversations with people in the crowd this week has been there's a lot of people who build things here, right? Like whether it's companies or projects or whatever, you're doing something, you're always building things. And so it's somewhat boring to talk about those kind of products or services that we build. What I think is interesting is, at least, and I think this is a more diverse topic than I can get into up here, but is how do you think of what to do? Like, where does that come from? And I think it's different for different people. Obviously, my way will be different than yours. But for me, I think it comes from kind of stillness and solitude, quiet. And it's hard to find that these days. So the way I think about it is you can often find more time to think if you're out doing something that you can't use your hands. Like, I used to think that, oh, it's you know, the smartphone, but I read a ton, so I'll just reach over and grab a book too, right? So there's multiple ways you can be distracted. But I think there's this magic in getting lost, but more importantly, or being bored, okay? So that's actually where I find most of my inspiration, right? And maybe even the word finding inspiration is wrong, because I don't think you can actually actively go find it. I think it comes to you a lot. But this being bored is important because it actually leads to where I am today, right? You're forced to sit in a space that's not always comfortable. You might not have charged your phone, or you might not have something to read, or you might be feeling a little air sick or whatever it is. And because of that, you just have to sit there. There's this great quote by Mr. Prissig, who's the author of Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, where boredom always precedes a period of great creativity. And I think that's been true in my life, that when I find time to be still, when I find time to be bored, more things happen and more juices are flowing. So that's what happened in, I think it was about December of 2011. I was down in South Africa, and I was flying back to Kenya. But right before I did that, I went and sat down with an entrepreneur friend of mine named Hank Kleinhans. He ran a company in South Africa called Skyrove, and Skyrove provided Wi-Fi at restaurants and hotels in Cape Town, primarily. And what was interesting about it was he was underfunded. All entrepreneurs, we're always underfunded. And he says, well, you know, I just can't get down further into the router. And I was like, well, why don't you build one of your own? He's like, that would take way too much time, it would cost way too much money. Of course he was right about that, but I didn't know that at the time. So on the airplane ride back, shortly after I left his restaurant, I started thinking, what would a router made for Africa look like, right? It's different, right? We actually get most of our internet signal from the SIM card, right? So why do we have an Ethernet port only in the device, right? We have power outages quite consistently. So what happens when that, you need some battery in it, right? Just kind of thinking through these different things, and I land in Nairobi. I'm talking to the Ushahidi team saying, hey, does somebody want to kind of volunteer with me on this? I'll find some money to put towards prototyping. And so that's what we did, right, over the next few months. Like, this first one looks like an IED, and I'm surprised. Like, I actually got this through multiple airports in my carry-on. It was unbelievable. We graduated to this fine-looking piece of equipment. I still didn't know anything about plastics. And then we finally got to something that was starting to look a little bit more brick-shaped. By the way, it's called brick because it's brick-shaped. There's no other reason. And funnily enough, I actually couldn't afford the eye. So there's too many masonry companies, right? So there's too many masonry companies, and they all have everything with brick already taken. So I found this guy who had BRCK, and I was negotiating back and forth with him. And my co-founder, Ushahidi, she was speaking at this conference in New York. And she says the name for the first time ever on stage. And I'm in the middle of negotiations. I'm like, oh no, it's going to double in price, right? And so I immediately just, you know, buy it from the guy. It was still kind of expensive, but at least I got a short domain. All right, so finally we got to this version. This is, you know, the model shot. And we're super proud, right? Like, this is actually hard to do. It's hard to make product. I didn't know this beforehand, thank God, because I came from software. If I had known it, I probably wouldn't have done it. But then, you know, you finally get to a final product, and you start shipping it out to people, and they're like, okay, man, we've really made it. Wow, this is awesome, right? And we ship this out to over 50 countries around the world. It's, you know, design engineered in Nairobi, software all done in Nairobi. Final manufacturing is always done elsewhere because Kenya doesn't have a good manufacturing base. But it's just this moment of pride for a lot of people, not just in our team, but in the country, because it's like we're the first company who's done a consumer electronics device in our country, right? So we're sitting there at the end of that year. So this is 2014, and we're sitting there at the end of 2014. We're like, what if we built the wrong thing, right? So we ship this thing out, and it's out there, and we're looking at, but I'm looking at the numbers, it's, you know, business guy, I'm looking at, I'm like, actually, this is a linear growth company. you know, and I can't do linear growth. We're venture backed, so we've got to do something different. And, you know, I want to tell a little aside to get to this, which is an interesting story in my life, because I think there's a lot that can be learned from it. So back in 1987, I think that's when that was, because it was the same week that Black Friday happened. That's how I remember that. The interesting thing that happened here was my dad and my uncle my uncle was visiting. And so we go on this walk with my uncle, my dad, my sister, and myself. And we're walking out towards that rise that you see behind you. And we look up on the hill, and there's some lions who are kind of stalking these antelope. Wow, that's kind of crazy. We're like just watching it. And you look a little further down, and somebody points out that there's a bunch of lions lazing around underneath it. You know, these guys are stalking, but everybody else is like, all right, you're on your own for now. And we're like, okay, that's kind of cool, but let's stop here. And we look a little further down the hill, and there's a couple lions stalking towards us. And, you know, I was probably 9 or 10 at that point, and I remember sitting there thinking, okay, what do we do now? My dad is like, okay, just start walking backwards, right? We're not going to walk forward anymore. But we can't turn either. These are cats, right? And so we start walking backwards towards camp and everything. We finally get back to camp. Why is that story important, right? Because I think so often it's easy to look out there and say, I'm solving this problem, right? I'm going after this thing. But it's a change of perspective just by looking down the hill that you see things are actually different than what you originally thought. So that was the rude awakening for us as Brick. We're technologists, and so we think we can solve all the problems with technology. And we're trying to do this with the internet in Africa, and we're having problems. So that opened up a new chapter then. We actually sat down at the end of the year and said, okay, what if we throw out everything we did and build something different? What is the right question to ask, right? And so maybe building the best and most rugged internet router in the world is interesting, but it's nothing really to write home about, right? However, if we solve the problem for creating this on-ramp to the internet in Africa, now that's something that we'd be proud of, right? And so maybe the question we should be asking is, how do we connect people to the internet? Not how do we make the best device for the internet? And so we sat back and started thinking about it, and one of the main things we thought is like, well, if you look at the internet, it's actually full of two buckets. If you just boil it down to a very simple state, you've got connectivity. You know, do you have a signal, and do you have a device that can connect to it, right? That's what we think about connectivity. But there's another side to connectivity, which is, can I pay for it? Can I afford it? So as technologists, we're looking at this, and we suddenly realize, oh no, we've solved the wrong problem. The technology is important, but it's not the most important thing. The most important thing is we have people who don't have a disposable income to pay, but they have the devices. So this is the funny thing about Africa. There's a lot of smartphones. The tipping point for smartphones was in 2016. Most people don't realize that, right? So you go into a lot of countries now, there's more smartphones than there is non-smartphones. But what are they used for? They're used for media. They're media devices primarily, except for the 20% who own the smartphones that can pay for the internet. And it's 20% in almost every country across the continent. So that other 80% has these smartphones and they're not utilizing them, and why is it important to be on the internet? Why do we get on the internet? Well, the reason why we get on the internet is we always want to communicate first, we want to watch, we want to be entertained second, we want to kind of figure out some kind of livelihood thing on it third, right? That's pretty much the basics of it. It's no different in Africa, right? And it's more important, I would beg as well, because if there's anything that we can do to bridge people into the global digital economy, that will make the biggest change. The reason that'll make the biggest change is we've had this kind of NGO culture for many, many years, where there's a lot of handouts and there's a lot of projects that are great as long as they're being funded and then they die, right? If we want to see real systemic change happen across the continent, it's about generating wealth, making sure commerce can happen more smoothly, making sure that you can set up a business easier. And it comes back down in real gritty ways. So, for example, if you wanted to get your driver's license in Kenya, you'd do that online today. So who's gonna get their driver's license then, right? By its nature, government services are favoring a few, right? So the same thing applies for a bunch of other things, whether it's, you know, like I said, commerce, marketplaces, education, healthcare, you know, all these different things are these pillars on top of which power and connectivity stand. And so if you're gonna solve a big problem, go for something like that. So what we did is we looked out there and said, well, where are people almost every day? Well, the public transportation system in Nairobi is a little messy. It's made up of these buses and vans called matatus. They're usually very colorful, very loud, but they're also something that you sit on, you know, 30 minutes to half an hour to an hour each way going to work. So you've got a lot of people on them, and they're looking for things to do. What we did is we deployed this Moja platform on a new piece of hardware. So we had to design something completely from scratch. So this is the SuperBrick. It's really one of the most ruggedized routers, again, but it's actually more than that. It's a data center. It's got hard drives and compute and everything in it. And so with that, we are able to run a public service that's free for end user to use. How do we do that? So they jump on this portal, if you will, like you're at an airport, right? We're all familiar with that experience. And they earn points on the system, and they can use those points for internet or premium content. What we do is we put, we have storage services on this, so everywhere these are in the country, companies pay us to store their content on it instead of just the central servers. We also find that that we're now quite well spread out. We're in 1,000 matatus in Kenya, 500 in Rwanda. We have 1,200 fixed locations as well, which makes us the second largest public Wi-Fi network in Africa, and with just over 500,000 monthly active unique users. So that's a pretty effective network that's out there. And the reason we can do it for free is because companies pay us. It's just an indirect revenue stream. So nothing really special about it, except for the fact that as technologists, it's really humbling to know that the technology isn't going to solve the problem, that you have to think about business models and everything else instead. So I guess, you know, when I think about this arc of my life and what it's looked like, it's looked like trying to solve problems in places where most people think are really hard. The matatus are actually the hardest place to install devices. Google and Safaricom, our big mobile operator there, both failed at this. And if you can do something in a place like this, it becomes really interesting to see how you can scale that to other countries. And if you can scale that to other countries, what you end up having is a platform that really can change the way people live, the way they work, and really the way they can earn. Because if they can earn, they can really change their lives. So as interesting it is for me to, you know, be getting people on Facebook, it's not the core reason why we do this. The reason we do this is so that people are able to have a better livelihood and be a part of the global digital economy. Thanks.
The Do Lectures is here to share stories of remarkable people in the hope they will inspire you to go and do amazing things too. There are over 300 talks to listen to, or if you prefer, watch on our website, thedolectures.com. Hit the subscribe button on your favorite podcast platform to get the latest episodes when they come out.